Like I said before, our next speaker is Sarah Connor.
Hello, good morning. Glad to see you all up so early on Monday morning, since there was a lot of celebrating going on last night. Okay, I have no disclosures to give you. So I'm here to talk about prostate cancer and communication. So why is it important that we're talking about prostate cancer? It is the most commonly diagnosed cancer among men. One in six men will be diagnosed with prostate cancer at some point in their lifetime. This year is expected about 240,000 men will be diagnosed in the United States, and approximately 30,000 men will die of the disease. If it is found early, it's basically 100% five-year survival rate. So it's really important that there's communication and understanding about screening and treatment. There is a suggestion that there is familial risk related to prostate cancer. It does seem to run in some families, which suggests there may be an inherited or a genetic factor. Having a father or a brother with prostate cancer more than doubles a man's risk of developing this disease. The risk is slightly higher if you have a brother who has prostate cancer versus your father. So it's really important in terms of discussing this that you know your family history of prostate cancer, because it allows you to make a more informed decision about whether you're going to be screened for prostate cancer. I'm sure, as a lot of you are aware, there is a lot of controversy going around about whether you should be screened or not screened for prostate cancer. Recently, the U.S. Preventive Task Force came out against screening at all. So, which I disagree with, because you need to make a screening decision, an informed decision about it, which means you need to know your risk. You shouldn't just generically say we're not going to screen with anybody or make it available to anybody. So I think those people who are at greater risk for the disease are now at a disadvantage, because the medical system really isn't going to be proactively screening or even potentially discussing the issue with them. So that makes it even more important that men understand their risk so that they can go to their doctor and tell them, listen, I do need to have this test because I have a father or brother who has this disease. Okay, so why are we focusing on Latinos? You know, they are the fastest growing population in the United States. There was a 43% increase in the Hispanic population in the United States between 2000 and 2010. Prostate cancer, again, is the most commonly diagnosed cancer among men, and Latinos are the fastest growing minority in the United States. So it makes it important for us to understand how and with whom Latino men communicate about prostate cancer. Additionally, Latinos are disproportionately uninsured, and for many, English is not their primary language. They also culturally have issues discussing side effects related to prostate cancer. The most common side effects are erectile dysfunction or impotence, and these are things that are not typically discussed among men, but particularly among Latino men. Okay, so the purpose of our study was to really develop an explanatory framework for how Latino men, the different communication processes they're using to discuss their prostate cancer diagnosis. So we recruited men from the UCLA Men's Health Study. This is a 13-year now longitudinal quality of life study that is conducted with men who enrolled in the IMPACT program. And IMPACT is California's free prostate cancer treatment program for uninsured or underinsured men. So these men are all at 200% of the federal poverty level. So just to give you an idea of who we recruited, 70% of the men had been diagnosed with prostate cancer within the last 3 years. The majority of these men underwent surgery to treat their prostate cancer. 67% of these men were under the age of 65. This is not unusual, because IMPACT does not take insured men, so most of these men don't have Medicare, so we're looking at men under 65. 70% were married or in a significant relationship, and the majority of the men had a grade school or less education level. So we conducted semi-structured, in-depth interviews that went from an hour to an hour and a half with men who self-identified as Latino and had a first-degree male relative with prostate cancer. These men also, the interviews were done in their homes by bilingual male interviewers. So we transcribed the interviews based on a method that our research team actually developed based on Brislin's principles, where we actually transcribe in Spanish and then translate the interviews. And we've actually found that this gives you more accurate translation and better conveys the meaning of the participants. Okay. We also used grounded theory as our methodology, and we also used symbolic interaction, which allows our allows an expansion on the grounded theory. By employing this type of methodology, we achieved complementarity. We were able to examine the overlap and the different facets of the different phenomena described by our men. We saw initiation, which is enabled us to discover fresh perspectives on the topics that the men were bringing forward. And we were able to expand on these subjects. It gave us a little more breadth and scope in these interviews. And each of these items is essential in laying a firm foundation for the subsequent development of educational interventions for first-degree relatives of men with prostate cancer. So we discovered that there were five spheres of communication. So we had our experts, which were essentially healthcare providers, their physicians, or men with prostate cancer. And essentially what they were seeking from the healthcare providers was information about how to be treated. What is your recommendation? I'm going to accept that recommendation. We've seen in several of our previous studies that healthcare providers are almost seen on a level of, you know, as gods in some of these men. And so they really accept verbatim what these physicians are recommending for them. In terms of men with prostate cancer, they became an avenue to discuss these issues that they wouldn't normally discuss. So issues of erectile dysfunction or impotence, they were more comfortable discussing this with these other men who had prostate cancer because they could relate to them versus even bring it up with their healthcare providers. Another sphere that we had was the inner circle. And these were their wives or significant others, and they were also their older adult children who, in most cases, were living with them. They were closest to the man with prostate cancer and had the potential to be most involved with his treatment and recovery. The third sphere that we found were individuals at work. This was their boss or their coworkers, and it was a very limited discussion. They provided only the minimum that they needed to do and were actually very closed off in terms of what they discussed with these men. They might tell them that I was going to have medical tests or that, yes, there's a problem with my prostate, but that was about the extent of the conversation. It was more of like, I need to have time off, so I'm going to tell my boss that I'm having some tests done or I may have surgery. But there was nothing beyond that. And in fact, they were very careful not to disclose potential limitations that they might have at work following their treatment. So the fourth sphere of communication we found were what we call beneficiaries. These were other men that after going through treatment that the man with prostate cancer felt would benefit most from their knowledge. It could be their son, other male relatives, friends, and sometimes coworkers. And the whole point of this was that we found that after treatment, men get very proactive at times about telling other people, you need to do something, you need to save your life, you need to go get screened. So don't be afraid of this test. Part of prostate cancer screening is basically a two-part test. So you have a blood test, and then you have a digital rectal exam. This, for most men, is the scariest part of the exam. There's a lot of concern that if they have this digital rectal exam, that they're gay, that they like men. As most activists in the prostate cancer field will tell you, if you have those concerns about having this exam, you've had them long before it even came up. It's really not that big of an issue. But these men are basically going to the point of saying, get over it. It's more important if you want to live, you need to have this test done. And then finally, the last sphere of communication is what we call the outer circle. These were relatives who were either geographically or emotionally distant from the man with prostate cancer. These could be relatives living in Mexico or out of state or even in a different part of the state. And they just felt they didn't want to burden these individuals because there's really nothing that they could do with them, do for them. If you're living in Mexico, you're not going to help me drive me to the doctor or help me go to radiation therapy or anything like that. So we're not going to tell you because we just don't want to burden you with that information. Okay. And we found that throughout these processes and the communication with these spheres, that there was an idea of respectful silence. And this was an idea of how the men were disclosing information and how the individuals receiving this information or who participated in their treatment responded back to these men. So a man may purposely not choose to speak to someone about their diagnosis, or they may only choose to disclose part of their diagnosis. And then in terms of respect for the gentleman with cancer, an older adult child may understand and be educated enough to know that there are issues with incontinence or impotence, but they wouldn't share this back to their father because they want to be respectful of what he's going through. And they also would be very careful about not even making jokes or things that might come up in conversation. So there's a lot of respect going back and forth between the parties and the different spheres of communication. The one exception to this was really their wives. The wives knew everything, and most of them participated and were actively involved in going to the doctor's appointments. So they knew everything about the potential side effects, what the men were going through, and were actively participating in this treatment and recovery with the gentlemen. So there's a very open discussion between these two parties. The other side of that is selective disclosure, and this was more an idea of what to tell to whom. And this was also influenced by the sphere and was very focused on the purpose of their interaction with the people in these spheres. This relates to the respectful silence in that the man with prostate cancer chose to disclose. The side effects were shared with their wives and oftentimes with the men with prostate cancer who they considered experts. They also shared with the beneficiaries and, you know, working to try and encourage them to get screened to help save their lives. And that was very much the emphasis on that area. And this is our framework. As you can see, most of the information going from the expert was going to the man. There wasn't much information going out. Work was just enough that they needed to know, very limited. The beneficiaries, it was more of a one-way street. It was information going to them. The inner circle, again, those closest to them and most involved in their treatment was very much a two-way street and very active, and those were the individuals most involved in these purposeful interactions. And as you can see, the outer circle, there wasn't anything, no information going to them, and this is really the group that we're very concerned with, because these are the family members who need to know about the prostate cancer diagnosis so that they can be aware of their risk. Okay. So, our analysis, uncovered an overarching process of purposeful interacting. Components of the process included spheres of communication, and each sphere was connected to purposes and content. Some spheres had partial overlap with others, and balanced within and influenced by the spheres were cross-cutting processes of respectful silence and selective disclosure. Each sphere had a unique purpose and content. Men communicated different information to different reference groups in symbolic interactionist terms. Reference groups are the multiple social worlds in which individuals interact, and how an individual presents himself within the various groups can often and does differ based on the views of the group and how the individual perceives the group to view him. The spheres of communication represent different reference groups, and the processes of respectful silence and selective disclosure can be viewed as the men's enactment of social interaction, using and choosing words based on symbolic meaning the men perceived would have their intended meaning for the people of each sphere. So there are several limitations to our study. Most of the men enrolled in the study were from Southern California, because these were in-person interviews, we had to limit the range of our interview that our interviewers are going to out to. So it was a 25-mile range radius from UCLA. But we really do believe that the concepts that we found and that relate to communicating about prostate cancer diagnosis can be transferable to other groups and warrant further investigation. While previous studies have identified a reluctance to communicate their diagnosis, our results provide evidence about the selectiveness of that communication. While there is some reluctance in some spheres of communication, there is a sense of helping others by communicating the prostate cancer experience in the beneficiary sphere. So our findings really suggest that we target men and their inner circle for educational interventions. Men need to understand the need for disclosing their diagnosis and providing culturally appropriate strategies to assist men with prostate cancer, their inner circle, and to inform first-degree male relatives. The potential to allow high-risk Latino men to be more proactive participants in informed decision-making regarding screening. So I'd like to thank Dr. Maliski, who's the PI of the study. Unfortunately, she couldn't be here today. She's in China. Dr. Litwin, who is head of the IMPACT program. Our interviewers, Mauricio Gutierrez and Jose Trabowski, and of course, always the men who shared their stories with us. Thank you.